This is The Conversation. It's episode 128 with Mark Thomas Gibson, New York-based painter, adjunct teacher, longtime Bushwick, Brooklyn resident. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com, where you can find some intriguing images, as always, to go along with this episode, as well as, of course, the back catalog of 127 other episodes. With Mark, we have what I would imagine is the first frank conversation about race on this podcast. And I think you'll find it particularly interesting to learn about the expectations that people bring to him based on his being black and what he should be putting into his work based on that. I was really surprising to hear the kinds of responses he's gotten in that regard. He also talks about how and why he finally ended up going to grad school after a 10-year break after Cooper Union, and about being a Bushwick resident. Last episode, 127, was with Queens-based video and animation artist Adam Schechter. I particularly appreciate the sentiment that Adam shared. Having a full-time day job at a school, high school, and why that he's happy to have that gives him the freedom to make the work that he needs to make. So check that out if you haven't heard that episode. And I want to thank Irina Jurek for connecting me with Mark. That episode with Irina is one of my favorites. If you haven't already, go check it out. I have some more information and some thank yous that I want to share with you on the back end. But until then, hope you enjoy this conversation, and I will talk to you on the back end. Ciao for now. Okay, cool. Well, I have a good starting point then, because you just said, correct me if I understood you wrong, but did you just say that race is something that you're usually hesitant to talk about?
Well, it was something I think I was a little bit more hesitant to talk about in the beginning with my work, because I feel that, it's complicated. There's like the personal, and then there's me, and there's my life, and then there's my identity. There's who I am as a black man in this country. And then I think it's like how an art, I feel that that's something that people feel like you must represent if you're a minority, and how you represent it. And a lot of that's kind of, can be kind of cultivated and kind of, I can go further, but,
I think the most important question that arises for me based on what you just said is, do you feel any pressure, either implicitly or explicitly, from individuals
I have felt pressure in the past. I think growing up, I started making art at a really young age, and that kind of conversation would come up, or like how, when I was in art school, I started in fifth grade down in Florida, and pretty early
so
on,
you're from Florida.
Like, you're going to go.
I'm sorry. So you're from Florida originally.
Yeah, I'm from Miami, Florida. So we have like the magnet art school programs. Mm-hmm. So I went to Rainbow Park Elementary was my first school for that. And then I went to New Orleans Middle, then New World School of the Arts. And, it was just kind of like a trajectory. But in that trajectory, one thing that was constantly brought up was that, well, you're black, you're an African-American, and you probably should think about going into design. Like how these two things equated one to the other, I don't really know. Huh. But I think it was the idea that you are a minority and it's like going to be basically impossible, and you're not wealthy, you're not like connected into the art world. Like, so it's going to be basically impossible for you to actually navigate this thing.
Right.
And as a school, you think like, oh, maybe there's some invested interest in them to try to figure out how to help me figure out how that it works. But, it was kind of like, oh, you should really just think about going into design.
Wow.
And that was kind of most of my education, even through college, even to that level, it was still there. That was still like kind of a catch-all.
To what degree were you a minority, growing up in Miami and then subsequently when you left Miami?
That changes. I went to predominantly white school. Mm-hmm. That was strange because for my sister, who's 9 years older than me, she couldn't go to the same elementary school that I went to. So it was basically in our district, but it was still in the 70s. It's a pretty segregated space. So I was able to attend there. I'm at elementary. And, you know, it was pretty much me and maybe a few other like black students. And even then it was still like very few Cuban students in this area particularly. Now this area is like completely, from what I understand, has been kind of, highly has kind of migrated into that area heavily. So it's a very, now it's a very Cuban area. But then in Florida, what they did is that they created like the, you know, there's the busing program, the idea of like taking black students and putting them into predominantly white schools that are well performing, you know, segregation, busing,
right?
Thing. So this was, with the magnet programs, their idea was that, well, we want to be able to put money into these poor black neighborhoods. How do we do it? And it's like, well, if we put magnet art programs like music and dance and theater, and then we'll bus kids in from all over the county to these schools. But these schools are like usually like super underperforming and also like majority black. So I was like from a predominantly black neighborhood, but I went to a predominantly white school for like until about fourth grade. And then at fifth grade, it all switched up. And then it was like, oh, I'm great. I'm around all these people who are like me. But then they're like, you sound funny. And then I'm like, oh, crap. You know,
right,
it's the same
right.
thing. It was like, so like never having a place. And
right.
I think like that type of switch up of like, I don't know, like that idea of like being able to talk like yourself and talk like street or talk like business, all that kind of stuff. Like all that was kind of early developed stuff that was happening to me there. And I think as you go through art and as you kind of, as I was in art school, you know, for me, it was kind of like, well, I have this kind of best of both worlds, but you could see in this program or in this way these programs work, it was like you were kind of treated, you know, special, like, oh, you know, these other kids aren't going to do anything with their lives. Your guys are going to be, you know, the leaders of tomorrow. And you're like, that's my friend, you know, like, how could you dare say that? How could you just put someone in that position? But that was like the way, you know, it was like, I got so much out of that experience because it showed me how, like, at an early age, how like classism is formed, how racism and classism are also intertwined with one another.
Right.
And that debate and that conversation, you know, some people don't like to have that conversation. Some people don't like to equate those two things together. But for me, I got to see it firsthand. Because I knew, had white friends who were really poor, who were from those neighborhoods that like were down with everybody because they were in the same like financial situation. But then you'd have like extremely wealthy, you know, kids coming in, affluent kids. And this is like, at least in my middle school, that was like around the time of like Rodney King and
right.
LA riots. So there was a lot of violence. There was a lot of anger. There's a lot of rage. So, and kids were having that conversation. Kids were dealing with that, you know, up close and personal.
One of the things I wanted to know from what you just said is when you, it sounds like you went from commuting to or going to a predominantly wealthy white educational environment to at some point a more of a minority dominated environment. And you said, and you said, they said you talk funny. I just wondered if there were others, at least one other anyway, you know, double outsider like yourself in that,
oh, yeah.
I mean,
there was a couple, you know, there was like Tammy, but she had come from the same school that I had gone to for elementary school. She was from the same place. So, you know, we were both kind of in that way. And she was from the islands, and like a lot of island people, you know, her parents are both teachers. So she also was kind of raised to like speak a certain way and to, you know, just, you know, this is proper English. This is how you're supposed to speak and this is how you're supposed to talk. And no, didn't see anything wrong with it until you're in an environment where like that could be the difference between you getting like ostracized or having a fight. And it was kind of ridiculous because then there was also teachers who also supported that idea. They were like, yeah, you sound funny. And you're like, what? Mm-hmm. You know, like, like, aren't you the teacher? And
right.
It's kind of like, I think for me, when it comes to like identity and race and race politics, personal politics, it's way more complicated than people assume, you know, like one size doesn't fit all. It's complicated. And I think that for me as an artist, I kind of felt younger when I was younger that I would kind of run into situations where people were trying to fit me into this one size fits all category.
Right.
And it was extremely frustrating. So I'm like, no, this is like supposed to be my space. This is supposed to be the world I create. This is supposed to be the thing that I get to do. that's mine. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. people are like, well, you know, if you really want to be effective, you want to do this, you want to talk about this thing, and you want to do that thing. And I'm like, well, who's this conversation for? Is this like for me? Is this for my community? Is this for people outside of my community? Like who's this for?
Yeah.
I just didn't really like that. I didn't really want to participate in that.
The angle in that I think is for me is most pressing is your experience. And so what I mm-hmm. want to know is the way that you talked about, you know, sort of this weird semi-condescending kind of suggestion that you needed to go into design, you know, when you were in magnet school, how, mm-hmm. if at all, are those kinds of assumptions, you know, or condescending assumptions made later on in the more proper art world, or even at some place like Yale, say, if at all?
Well, I think at Yale at that point, you know, that was already like kind of a foregone thing that was like kind of past that point. You know, it was like there wasn't anyone sitting there saying to me like, oh, you need to do this kind of
mm-hmm,
thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the conversation might come up, you know, ideas about identity and where are they prevalent in my work and not. Because, I mean, at the time when I come back to school and I took some time off, I took like almost a decade off between undergrad and grad school, that I was making like landscapes.
Mm.
I was doing a lot of like meditation and I was doing running in the morning and then Prospect Park. And I started doing these kind of like Zen ink drawings and landscape drawings of my experience in there. And, you know, I had this whole complete thing talking about like surface elements in a painting and ideas around sublime and romanticism. And like, that's what I applied to school with. And I also was making work that was kind of this I kept repainting these caves, and it had a lot to do with the death of my grandmother and my belief system and her Christian belief system and this idea and this desire to want to see her in the afterlife. You know, like I had this, you know, my own personal conversational things, and some people would be like, well, you know, so what does this have to do with you being a black man? You know, people ask you that straight up. And,
right.
And to me, that's like kind of like, wow, all my white artist friends, I've never heard anyone ever ask them, why did they do that?
Yeah.
You know, why are you making that? You know, like what this abstraction, what does that have to do with your German heritage?
Right.
You know, what does that have to do with your Irish heritage? You know, you know, why aren't you doing something Celtic? Green would be a great color for you to use, you know?
Sorry to interrupt that. That's the answer really right there to my question, which is, I don't know what if you want to put a percentage on it, but a substantial number, it sounds like, of your white artist colleagues are asking you, you know, how does this connect to your black heritage, which is ridiculous.
Well,
you know, it's a double standard.
Sorry, go on.
I was just saying it's a double standard.
Well, it's a double standard, but it's a double standard not just being presented by my white colleagues, it's by my, you know, black colleagues too. You know, it's I think, like, I've had this interest in history my whole life, right? My parents are both history majors when they went to college.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't go into that in any way in their lives, but, you know, in my house, it was like Sunday morning, we watch all like the shows, Meet the Press and Face the Nation and all that. But then we pretty much would spend the rest of the day arguing about that.
Wow.
And we have a strong debating home, and like my girlfriend came down and she was like sitting there with my dad, and you know, we'll take like crazy positions on things just to like irk the other person into like having the debate about the position, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, like my interest in like history, my interest in politics, like that's something I never thought I would ever bring it up in my work. And I slowly am finding ways to kind of bring it into it. And I'm trying to like suss that out, but it's strange. It's like, I don't know. It's like, you know, one of the things that you were going to bring up about this like idea of like a humbling moment, right? And it actually, the thing I thought of was when I was probably like a year or so out of school,
mm-hmm.
I kind of slowed down on making work.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, what the hell am I going to do with my life? So my friends were starting to show, and there was this one particular gallery in Chelsea that was like, had an interest in young artists. So
mm-hmm.
I showed the guy my work, and he's flipping through it and he's looking at it. I'm making these like abstract paintings, kind of goofy. I mean, God, if I looked at them now, they're horrible.
Uh-huh.
But he's looking at them. He's like, wow, these are really good. I really like them. But like, but what does this have to do with your ethnicity? And
oh,
I was
geez.
Just like, and I was, remember just sitting there going like, and you're like, I'm a 23-year-old kid, you know, or 22-year-old kid at the time. And I'm like thinking in my head, like, I don't know if I should tell this guy to go, fuck off.
Right.
Or like, what? And I probably should have.
Right.
But, you know, I just, in my head, I'd never really had anyone support me in being able to say fuck off to that person in that situation.
Right.
Or to say fuck off when someone thinks that they can, like, identify you and that way. And also to say, like, this is what you should be doing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is how, this is, if you want to make it in this world, kid, like, why aren't you talking about this? Why aren't you doing this? And it's also, if you're not doing this, then you're performing your ethnicity improperly.
Right.
And I'm like, well, this guy in this case was like a white guy. And I'm like, who the hell are you to tell me how I'm supposed to, like, effectively be me as a person?
Right.
And,
right.
And I think that's for me, it's always kind of troubling, you know, it's always, I think about that moment a lot.
Yeah.
Because I know that for some people, you know, for some women, they probably get like asked certain things about, like, you know, gender and like, how does that reflect in their work? And maybe their work isn't gendered in the way that, like, people would want it to be gendered.
It still feels like a really naive comment. And I just wonder if, you know, how a decade plus, you know, a decade and a half, I assume roughly later, if that's a lot less likely to happen, at least.
No.
No? Has it happened recently in the last couple of years?
Happened like a month ago.
No shit.
I had a guy in my studio, and he was like, you know, nice guy. I like him.
Uh-huh.
But he's looking at my werewolf characters. I explained to him, like, yeah, the last spell idea has to do with manifest destiny, and the idea of manifest destiny being a curse, and like, in this kind of creation of American culture, it's a curse, and we're all infected by it. So the characters in my book, they're all like, or this book I'm working on, they're all werewolves, you know, they're all transformed in this way.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, well, how do I tell if this character is black? And I'm like, well, I could put an afro, give him a pip if you want, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, because I think, like, does this character need to pass, like, a brown paper bag test for you?
Right.
You know, like, you know, and why is that so significant for you?
Right.
And is that because you want to have things on your wall that tell people that's what you buy?
Yeah.
or is it about, like, you actually understanding and caring about what this thing is?
I want to give people listening an opportunity to get inside your head in a specific way. And that is, what kinds of things should people, especially sort of clueless about race or just clueless about diplomacy, people know what to ask and what not to ask? Or just, you know, what's a general outline of your experience that people should know and in turn make sensible choices about?
I mean, that's huge. I mean, that's really huge. I mean, I can speak to my own experience, and I can speak to, like, what I observe to some degree. And this is the way I can maybe sort of answer this. I was recently having a conversation with some of my friends about reparations.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm saying to them, the reason why I don't really think that this country could do something like that is because we lack the compassion to do things like that. And I think we also lack that type of compassion with other artists, other people. Like, I see a lot for me in my own experience, and a lot of other artists, young artists, people come to them with a lot of outside stuff instead of just, like, dealing with the person who's standing in front of them or the work that's in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're living in an odd time, because I think, especially when I've been talking to a lot of people about gender too, because I'm a hetero dude, but this conversation about pronouns and them and they, and I think for some people, it's a really frustrating proposition, because it means that I have to slow down, and I have to, like, look at the person in front of me, and I have to talk to the person in front of me and understand them.
Right.
I have to take the time to like appreciate their own understanding, their self. Mm-hmm. And I think that sometimes when art gets kind of caught up in like, you know, well, you know, if you museums and money and galleries and exchange and, you know, visual streamlining, and it's like visual annotation, that we get away from, like, you know, when you slow down and you can look at like a Jacob Lawrence piece and like, you know, just the exhibit that we had here at MoMA,
right,
the migration series, you know, you will slow down and you can look at like each one of those things and you can just like lose yourself in that piece. You know, that's, for me, art, that's what it's kind of there for, to kind of like lose yourself a little bit and put yourself in that other person's shoe, be a part of that conversation. And I think that's something I try to do with most people I meet and most people I deal with. I teach. So like, that's also this a great experience of like, you know, sometimes I'll find myself having an idea of a person in my mind. And then when I sit down and I speak to this person, I slow down, I learn so much more mm-hmm. than I ever could have imagined from this other person's experience. And I don't think it's to ask too much from people. You know, like, I had this great experience where I got to, I was in Houston and I got to meet with Trentville Hancock, and I got to go to his studio and I was like talking to him, and, you know, and we started talking about like world building, creating a world for ourselves, creating, seeing the things that we want to be, manifesting them in a way. This act of just not just imagining, but also creating, physically producing. And that self, that individual self-generation and manipulation of materials to create something, I was like, you know, that's all I've ever really wanted to do. And I think I just had been for so long creating little tremors or little startups or little bits of things, you know, a chair, a lamp, a character, you know, something like that. And this new project that I'm working on, it was kind of like a reason to, you know, it was an ability or a chance to like finally do it, you know, like, okay, just snap it together. And then while doing that thing, to kind of speak to your point or your question, I started kind of saying, like, really kind of like finding my position a little bit more in the world mm-hmm. and just kind of like a little bit more defined, even more so than I thought was going to happen a year ago when I started this, like, was to go like, oh crap, this is who I am, you know, take it or leave it. Now I can walk out the door now if I want, you know, yeah. I can ask you to leave if I want, because it's like, I know where I'm sitting today right. with myself, you know?
Well, first of all, just a quick question and then a more longer question, I think is, where do you teach?
I teach, I am a part-time lecturer at, Rutgers. Mm-hmm. I'm off this semester, so mm-hmm. I have a show coming up, so I just need to work on that. And I also, I'm a visiting artist for Cooper Union.
Oh, wow. Which is your alma mater, right?
Yeah, which was like a huge honor. I mean, yeah. Like on a huge level. I mean, for me, that place was like scary and weird. And, you know, I left Miami and came to New York and didn't know anybody. And,
right.
you know, but I still, like, I have friends, my, you know, studio mates and friends, people I met like the first day there, mm-hmm. I still know like 18 years later. So, mm-hmm. You know, I love that place. It's an incredible space.
I was just going to, otherwise I was going to refer to your meeting and get together with Trenton Doyle Hancock. Cause I don't know too much about his background, but I if I remember right, I mean, he certainly has a big comics are a big influence on him. And so I guess I wonder how much your sort of personalities / backgrounds overlapped.
Yeah, I think it was just like we both had a young black nerd experience.
Right.
And just
right.
kind of, you know, understanding culture, understanding like, you know, like we could talk for like 2 hours about Zelda, you know, like we have these, you know, just these likes and love of like imagination and play and, mm-hmm. And creating like spaces to like play.
Right.
And he has a really great lecture and it's just super formatted. It's like extremely like tailored. And at the time when he did it, I was kind of like, this is strange. And like, what kind of like bizarre performance is this? And now I get it so much more that he's trying to create something that's so specific and it's his, and he doesn't want it to be like tied into or around other things. Like, he really wants it to be like, no, this is what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm being 100% honest with you. This is what I'm actually doing.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like, it was just great for me to hear that. And like, it was great for me to take the time and learn and understand why he was doing that. And now that I've started to try to do my thing, the specific thing, I get it more now.
Mm-hmm.
I get it why you don't let people just take the words or take the imagery and like equate it to all these other things or create these other associations that aren't really there, and just be honest about like, oh no, this is actually what I'm really interested in. Or like, I'm really interested in the Alamo. Like, I'm really interested in like, Manifest Destiny and early American history in the early 19th century, you know, like that kind of stuff is what I read about. And
I think that answers a question which I had in my head as you were saying that, which is, why are you an artist as opposed to, you know, like a really ambitious contemporary graphic novelist or something like that? And the answer is because I'm guessing maybe that one of the answers is that art can take on history and comics and you know, several other things. Maybe more better than a more sort of finite graphics or comics kind of format can.
Yeah, I think that like the idea of being fixed was always kind of like a problem for me. The idea of like, okay, so if you're this type of thing, if you're making this type of work, this is what you should be making. You know, like if you're a designer, you should be designing X, Y, and Z. And if you're a painter, then you're making paintings, and there's this history, and it's this really false linear way of thinking, and that's what you're a part of. And I think for me, I just had this like love of freedom. Doug Ashford, I don't know if you know him, but he said to me once, this, I didn't take him when I was an undergrad. I ended up taking him in grad school, but in undergrad, one time in passing, we had this weird conversation, and he said to me that, like, you know, great being an artist, you get to say whatever you want and wear whatever you want.
Right.
And like that always kind of like resonates like in those moments of doubt, you know, like, or when I want to try to take something else on.
Right.
And I knew that like my hand has a graphic quality to it. So people would be like, well, why don't you do comic books? Why can't you do comic books? And I'm like, I don't really, that's not my thing. And I don't really want my drawings like to be seen as like a comic book. I want them to be seen as like images, like like single images. So the book I've made, it's like, it's basically like splash pages, which are like those pages that usually come at the beginning or an end or like a significant shift in the book. And I wanted to just be like shift after shift after shift after shift.
Mm-hmm.
And like just like single image that you can just take in and look at, you know, right, that you could just fall into the story at any point in a way.
Yeah.
But I think that's where like art books and art thinking, that type of art thinking, because I used to have this real conversation with myself about like high and low all the time. Like, oh, well, like I liked comic books as a kid. So I was kind of like beaten out of me to like do comic book stuff. You can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
That's not art.
Mm-hmm.
That's not art.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, who are these people? Like, who are these people? Like, how is that expanding minds? You know, like, how is that like challenging convention? Like, instead, it's just like, no, let's talk about, you know, Italy in the 1500s, you know. And I'm like, it's important. It's very important, valid. But, you know, let's also talk about, like, what can we do with the materials that we have today in front of us? And what do they mean? People aren't really having that conversation around the graphic novel until you have, like, the New York Times writing about, like, The Watchmen.
Right.
You know, that kind of stuff.
Right.
And then people are like, ooh, culture. Like, yeah, man, it's culture down there.
let's get back to more of your arc, because I'm interested in particularly the fact that you took, as you said, a decade off after undergrad or, you know, art school, which is something that I myself kind of regret not having done, you know, because I went right from undergrad into grad school. So why
did you go to grad school?
Hunter.
All right, cool. Yeah.
Yeah. So why did you end up taking that much time off?
Well, a lot of crazy things happened. I think it was like the summer leading into my senior year, and I remember like hanging out with my roommates in my dinky little apartment, and I'm thinking to myself, like, man, I should really do something, you know, like I should join the military or something. I should, like, and I really thought about it because every man in my family served, and we're not like, definitely aren't like, we're very liberal people. But it was kind of a thing.
Huh.
And, my grandfather, my mother's father, he died in the Korean War. My cousin served, you know, dad, everyone. So
was your father in Vietnam then?
He was complicated. They basically thought he committed arson at his college, and he did not. And he was kicked out. And so the draft was on. So he showed up, and when he was going to be drafted or be brought in, what is it called? Selective service. Basically, you could go in and just say, okay, I'm entering. But he said, like, I'm not going to go over there to kill people in that country for you. If my family can't get treated right in this country, why the hell am I going to go over there and kill these people? So you can do what you want, throw me in the brig or whatever, but I'm not going to do that. So they sent him out to Austin, Texas to work an airfield. And he ended up meeting my mom, and that's how that went down.
Wow.
So
he served domestically.
Yeah, so he was able to serve domestically, but he was just like, I'm not going to do it.
Right,
like, I'm not going to kill people for you.
You probably wouldn't have had that luxury if you had joined the military necessarily, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think for me, the idea of joining the military, even though my mother's father died in the Korean War and they never got his body back, and there's, you know, she's from the South and she's from Texas, and she's still very, you know, we have a flag on 4th of July. Her birthday is July 1st. You know, like, she's very, supports the troops, you know, very, very, not pro-war, not pro like that, but like really the idea of service is really important to her.
Mm-hmm.
And sacrifice is very important to her because she's lived it. And but the idea of me, like, I could never have a toy gun. I could never, like, G.I. Joe's was a really sketchy thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because for them it was like propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
So, but for some reason I felt this desire. And then, like, second day of school of my senior year, like, 9/11 happens. And so that happens. And that was a crazy day, of course. And, you know, that was this moment of, like, my mother calls me up and she's like, you're not going to go in the military.
Mm.
She didn't, like, that's the first thing she said to me.
Wow.
And I was just like, and, you know, she knew what I was thinking.
Wow.
You know, and I, you know, we had a conversation and I didn't serve.
Right.
But there's times when I think about it. And I mean, and it's ridiculous that I even think about it. I mean, God, you know, it's like George Bush, man, you know, like you awoken a sleeping giant, you know, like that ridiculous crap, you know, everything that was happening, it was against everything I actually believe in. You know, it's really like, you know, I was in that moment when 9/11 happened, I was thinking, like, this is an incredible moment for, like, to possibly create some change, some type of, like, turn the other cheek, peace moment, you know, like some other kind of crazy thing that we could do. And no, we just, like, went right into it. You know, maybe I was just 21 and naive. So, you know, when that's kind of happened and you've seen such, like, horrible thing happen in front of you, and then people are like, let's make art. Like, I was just kind of like, what are we doing?
Right.
You know?
Right.
It just seemed kind of hollow. And I was like, and I kept thinking in my head, like, as the year kept going on, and, you know, my friends are sitting there, and, you know, we were still dealing with the postmodern debate and yada, yada, yada. That was kind of falling apart. Kind of things like this weird gap that, like, post 9/11 kind of created was just, like, throwing out of isms and shit. And that was great.
So you were basically disillusioned with pretensions of the art community and, you know, and sort of ambitious art making, and you wanted to sort of join the real world, something along those lines?
Yeah. Yeah, something along those lines, but, you know, realizing I had no skills for that was part of it. You know, I was kind of like, oh, wait, I can't just paint for you.
So what kind of jobs did you get?
So my first job was like, like 2 weeks before we left school, I stopped painting altogether. And my friends were like, what are you doing? And I'm like, I don't see the point in this. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm 21 years old. Like, what do I know about life to really, like, make a painting, mm-hmm. you know, to really talk about anything. Mm-hmm. So I got a job working at Matthew Marks. So I did that for like a couple months mm-hmm. and that was tough.
Why?
Well, it was just a stressful place, you know, yeah. It's just like, you know, it's a really big blue chip gallery. There's a yeah. lot of money at stake and, yeah. you know, it's just one of those things where people are can be very nasty and very yep. condescending and you're young. And so you eat crap.
Were you a preparator or clerical?
Yeah, I was a preparator. Okay. Yeah, uh-huh. I was a preparator. So, right. you know, big guy, muscular, strong enough at the time to do that kind of stuff.
Right. Right.
And so I was an art handler, like so many of us are. And I did it and, you know, that ended. But the guys, a lot of people I met there, you know, there's still people I see in Chelsea or see around and they're like great people. But, you know, it was just a very intense, very strange environment. And also this was like the economy of post 9/11 and art market right after that. And, mm-hmm. you know, Wall Street, everything was kind of, you know, in a downturn
right.
for a period of time after that. And a lot of my friends didn't have jobs. So like, I couldn't really be in a situation to be like, man, you know, this sucks, you know, because all my friends have been unemployed for 4 months because they're artists and they're trying to find a job in New York City.
Right.
So, you know, you live through it and you see what that is. You know, it was just like, and you know, it's like any other like gallery job, you know, there's moments when you're like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm doing this. This is the worst thing I've ever done in my life. And then, you know, there's moments where you're like, wow, these people are really incredible, but there was way more of the prior than the latter.
Yeah.
There. Yeah.
What was it then that led you back to school ultimately?
Well, a lot of crazy things happened. I just like had broken up with a girlfriend. I ended up on my friend's couch, but I guess right prior to that, like, okay, so more economic downturn. Mm-hmm. So 2008 happens and I'm working at Crozier with my friend Janine and we're sitting there doing data entry and we're like listening to NPR and we like just hear how the stock market's tanking and how everything's falling apart.
Yeah.
And we look at each other and we're like, we're getting laid off, dude. And so I just like started like saving cash. My girlfriend at the time, you know, I was, you know, told her like, okay, this is the money situation. I've saved up this. I think I'm going to start making paintings. And she's like, what? And I'm like, for me, that made the most sense. And I started making these oil paintings. The relationship tanks because I'm sitting at home making paintings. And I ended up on a friend's couch. My other friend, my friend Cadell Brock, I ended up staying with him and my friend Matt Jones. And Matt decides he wants to move in with his girlfriend. Also around the same time, since I started making paintings, Kadar decides he wants to do like a group show. So it's like John Newsome, Catherine Bernhardt, Wendy White, Kadar, I think he might have put his own work in it, and Matt Jones, right? And it was called Quick While Still. It was at a pop-up space, and, you know, I saw something. And I'm like, okay, all right. And, you know, in a weird way, like, I was in a total, like, fog. You know, it just came out of a relationship I was in for 3 years. I had not been making artwork for so long. And then all of a sudden, this guy's, like, kind of, like, cheering me along and kind of, like, showing me the ropes of, like, you know, let's get you a studio. Okay. Mm-hmm. You know, like, let's, like, try to do something else. Like, okay. You know, and I'm just kind of, like, going along with it. And I start doing studio visits and people keep coming into my studio and I'll have a conversation with them. And I don't know, I wasn't probably meeting with the best people at the time because I was meeting with people who would just be like, super freaking condescending, just like ridiculous, man. Just like, I don't know, I want to talk to me about Nietzsche and all this other stuff. And I'm like, yeah, I know that. And they're like, oh, do you? And I'm like, yeah, man. Like, I went to Cooper Union. Like I mean, honestly, I was reading grad level stuff there. And like, that's what you take in while you're there. And, you know, it was just like kind of like this weird thing. And then people would say to me, like, over and over again, like, you should really think about going to grad school. And I was just like, man, school is out, baby. Like, I don't know what you're talking about. Like, nah, I've done my time. I've been in art school longer than you. Most people have been alive. You know, like, I was just like real, like, done with it. And we did this, the show traveled to Japan. And this gallery at the time called Modus Fort, run by this guy, Jeffrey Chido, who had gone to Yale for photography, he kept trying to get me on like FaceTime. And I was like, I don't really want to talk to you. You're kind of strange. I don't want to talk to you. And he's like, you must talk to me. And I was like, okay, fine. And so he starts talking to me and he starts asking me about my work. And he starts talking about, you know, what I'm doing with myself and all this other kind of stuff. And he's just like, you, I believe, should go to grad school. And I'm like, yeah, dude, you should, you know, I was like, F you. I was going to like, you know, totally click off. And then he just explained it, you know, like really got down to the bare, you know, honest, you know, not condescending, not like, mm-hmm. I know more than you. And we can't even have a proper conversation because obviously you're not into, you know. He was like, no, you're smart. You got it. You know, you make great work. You can make better work. You know, I think this is something that would benefit you, you know. Mm-hmm. And from there, I started to think like, oh, crap, maybe I could do this thing. Maybe it is something there for me. Maybe I was such a young punk when I was I felt I was way too young for undergrad. Looking back, I should have taken a year off or something. But I got this moment. I had this moment where like I was like, oh, okay, maybe I can make up for all the things that I missed out on, all the things I didn't quite understand at the time. Like I'm a little bit more mature now. I can sit there and focus on these things in this conversation, and I started just making the work. I started doing all this reading. I started writing a ton. I started doing, you know, kind of reamping myself up. And I applied. And when I applied, I wasn't 100% even sure I wanted to do it. I was kind of like half in, half out. And then I ended up going to the campus and I go to their, like, the museum they have. And I was just like, oh, crap. Oh, my God, I want this. Oh, man, I want this. Crap. And,
how many places did you apply?
Just applied to one.
Wow. Is that why? Is that where people told you to go?
That's where everyone kept saying to go. That's where everyone just kept saying to go. And I thought about Hunter because, like, I had been living in the city long enough to, like, financially it would work out for me. And I had known people throughout my life had gone there. And I used to go to their open houses. And, mm-hmm. you know, great place. And a lot of the professors that would teach at other programs, since they were in the city, they would be there. Mm-hmm. So I really had thought about that. I had always had thought about that. Like, if I ever was going to go back to grad school, that was the school I was originally always thought I would just do.
Mm-hmm.
And, but then, you know, that dream kind of went away. So when it got reignited and people kept saying this thing to me, I honestly didn't really have a clear sense of like the history of their program or any of this stuff. I was just kind of like, I was kind of like, all right, you know, like I want to try.
Right.
And I'm going to keep following this thing that I'm doing and wherever it leads me.
And then you got
in. I know it sounds it sounds hokey. I know it sounds weird or something, but yeah.
And then you got in and you must've been very relieved.
Wasn't relieved. It was more like, awesome. I can't believe this is actually happening to me. Like, this is insane. And I called up my old man, my dad, and I was just like, oh, I got into Yale. I'm like the first, like, I mean, my aunt, she has her PhD, but like, I'm kind of like the other person to get that degree.
Right.
And so I, you know, he was like, oh, great. Well, I'm not paying for it. And I'm like, you don't have to. not because like I got any cash or anything, just because like, you know, I'm not calling you to tell you that, dude. I'm just saying.
Right.
Be happy for it, dude. But, you know, so they, you know, so then I was kind of off and then I had to start making the plan and getting moved out of the city and all that.
Right. Speaking of the city, the place that I've been starting usually with people in New York is what neighborhood they're in, because I think neighborhoods and the, you know, in New York City is the story of real estate and the story of the economy.
Oh yeah.
And and so you're in Bushwick, and I think I've only had one other guest that I can recall that's in Bushwick based. But tell me, tell us, you know, the listeners, what it's like being in Bushwick, you know, circa 2016, because not that long ago, 10 years ago, as little as 10 years ago, it was, maybe you can tell us a little bit about the arc, but what I'm getting at is Bushwick basically what Williamsburg was?
Yes and no. Mm-hmm. It's like that's done. Like what happened in Williamsburg around the early 2000, like that feeling that like the music, you know, post 9/11 energy, kind of a fuck it attitude kind of thing. Like that all kind of is, people are doing it here, but they're not, it's not the same citywide feel. But, you know, I had a friend who used to live out here about 7-8 years ago. And when I moved into this neighborhood after school, it took me about 2-3 months to realize that I was actually like a block away from where my friend used to live, mm-hmm. because they just changed so much. They just cleaned up so much.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I like the idea that the one thing about this area of Bushwick that I live in particular, it just seems there's a lot of families and a lot of homes and a lot of people who've been there for a long time, and that they're not going to move anytime soon. There are popping up a lot of condos and things around here. But, you know, like even like the local bar is like a place where I end up running into a lot of art friends and a lot of other people, you know, and it's not like a crazy, crazy thing. It's almost like the turkey's nest, but without like the old local flair. It's like, it's trying to change, but in a weird way, it almost can't change because architecturally it's not really made for that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think all the quick money and all the money that has learned how to like, to monopolize on these things. Okay. So like getting a studio out here is like next to thing happening, you know, like for what I was paying in my first studio to what I would be paying now for the same type of space is insane. It's nuts.
Mm-hmm.
And, I thought like when moving out to Bushwick, oh, I could find a place like right near where I live. Cause it's Bushwick. It's way out here. Like who the hell? And you know, that was 2 years. I left and I came back and that completely had already changed. So I was lucky enough to get a space back in my old building. So now I'm commuting back to my old neighborhood. There's a little bit more Williamsburg or East Williamsburg.
Mm-hmm.
It's like I can walk, you know, on a nice day I can walk there. But, you know, it's just like, you know, but there's our little art spaces that are popping up around here. It's, you know, when they have the whole Bushwick art festival in the summertime, like it's migrated over to here, because now that festival or that is now, you know, sponsored by, you know, liquor companies and stuff like that.
Right.
It's, you know, that, but that's, you know, that's the nature of the beast, I guess, you know, that's just the way it goes.
But I'm interested in I think I'm interested also though in the demographic, because the perception from outside is that because it's at least, even if it's changed a lot, it's still more affordable than the other parts of Brooklyn. So are there a really large majority of artists in Bushwick, or is that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like most of the people when I'm walking around, like, yeah, you're either in a band or something, but, you know, you're up to some type of, you know, personal enterprise. You know, you're up to doing something, making your own thing. Mm-hmm. You might be working a day job, but you also have this other thing going on. But at the same time, though, there's still a lot of, like, you know, families and people here still.
Right.
And that's what, like, actually I like about it, where in Williamsburg, you know, it used to be that you have to go down to, like, South 3rd, you know, South 2nd to still kind of see, like, people who have been here for a long time.
Right.
You know, but that's, you know, changed. And it's going to change even more now because they're talking about shutting down the L for, like, maybe some estimate, crazy estimate, maybe like 2 years. Like
right.
2 years if they should have done all the way, and then maybe 7 years if they do intermediate, like little parts of it. And like, I look at my neighborhood, I'm like, well, are people really not going to move over here more because of that? And what is that shift going to mean? And will that mean, you know, priced out? Yeah. I mean, and this is the first time I've actually lived in an apartment where I have no desire of moving to another apartment. Like if I'm moving again, I'm moving out of the city altogether.
Right.
Because so, it's just like financially, it's just insane.
Practically speaking, how are you going to get around when this temporary, you know, disabling of the L happens?
Well, I'm not to tell over the world, but I'm off M train and like the JMZ. And that train is, and it's surprisingly awesome.
Oh, good.
And I mean, the M train takes you right to MoMA, basically the doorstep of the museum, and you could connect in the city to anything else. So it's pretty incredible. I enjoy it.
Right.
You know, you have Mr. Kiwi down the way and organic, good, fresh vegetables.
Mr. Kiwi? Is that what it's called?
Yeah, it's called Mr. Kiwi. It's like a chain. There's like, you know, I think it's like, I forget what the other ones are called. I know there's probably people like from this neighborhood listening to this and they're like, what the hell, man? He's like, doesn't get it. He's not, you know, whatever. I'm just telling you what I do.
Right.
This is what I do.
Okay. Got it.
Yeah. But it's like, you know, I'm back. I'm here. I get to go to my studio. I've kind of like navigated a life that still causes me to have a lot of like struggle because I don't work as much as like, I don't work a 9-to-5 anymore.
Yeah.
Like I do freelance work with people. I teach and there was a time, okay, this is what changes in 2008 for me. 2008, I was raised in a house where my dad worked like for 40 years for the post office. He was the postmaster, first black postmaster of Homestead, Daytona Beach, a couple other cities in Florida, I forget. So he'd been working since the age of 13. And his whole thing was like, you get a job, you do that job, and people respect you, and you become part of your community. That's it. And he didn't understand that we're living in a new economy where that don't happen. Mm-hmm. Like where you're going to have like 20 jobs in your life. You're going to work for lots of different people.
Yeah.
And your skills will be varied and not specialized to one thing. And in 2008, when that whole economic downturn happened, recession, depression, whatever, that I was just like, that was a click for me. It's like, no, screw like trying to hold on to this job and working for these people to make millions for them. Like, screw it. Like anytime I'm in a job now and I start to feel like I'm just reducing for other people to like build up their thing, I'm just kind of like, I'm out.
Right.
And if I feel like I'm at a, and if I'm struggling and I'm working for you like 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, like there's something wrong because I wasn't put on this earth to do that.
Yep.
And I don't think a lot of people were, but so my main mantra, I guess, in living now is trying to figure out like, okay, what do I need to make me happy? What do I need to make this work happen? How much money do I need to make to do this? Does that mean I have to hustle? Yeah. Does that mean I have to like, you know, me and my friend Kadar, you ever seen the Joan Rivers documentary?
Yeah, part of it. Yeah, I think I saw the whole thing. Uh-huh.
All right. So there's a part where she's talking about Richard Pryor, and Richard Pryor goes to his manager, and the manager was like explaining to Richard like 5 years out, like all the things that are happening to him, like the Tonight Show dates and book deals and movies and all that stuff. And then Richard says, yo, man, yo, slow down. What about Monday? And like for me and my friend Kadar, that was like something we would say to each other like all the time. Mm-hmm. Like, what about Monday? We still say it to each other because no matter what, and he's doing extremely well, you know, he's got an awesome career and he's making great work. But
what's his name, by the way, for people listening? Kadar what?
Kadar Brock.
Got it.
K-A-D-A-R.
Okay.
But we talk, I you know, but we still say this thing to each other. What about Monday? You know, we'll see each other in passing. What about Monday? And it's just like to think about, like, no matter where you're at, you still are trying to push yourself. You're still trying to work out these ideas. You're still trying to do your best, be your best. And that, it's funny because it kind of came up in a little comedy skit, but for me, like comedy and like reading about comics, comedians, that their lives, their struggle to speak honestly about themselves and their experience on a stage in front of people, I think is extremely important. And I think is like something for, as an artist, something to strive for to some degree. And I find it more so in them, and hearing comedians or reading about comedians' lives than sometimes I do with other artists. And I don't exactly know why. I just have always felt that way. I've always, like, you know, I'll sit there and read about, like, George Carlin, and I'm, like, so interested, and I see his problems and his foibles, and I see his creation. I see how he felt he was a sellout, and then he decided to, like, you know, I'm going to try to start reading and learning more about this stuff. I'm going to go hang out with my writer friends who write for the Village Voice, and I'm going to, you know, take whatever information they give me, and I'm going to start understanding these things, and I'll start to cultivate my own ideas and do the work, and then deliver it to people and see where it goes from there. Or, like, you know, Pryor and his honesty and his life and his crazy upbringing, you know, and that almost, like, kind of almost involuntarily, like, kind of creeping out, because he wanted to be like Bill Cosby, and he wanted to be, like, you know, quote unquote, like, that digestible black guy. Mm-hmm. And then he got kind of called out for, like, stealing Cosby's jokes. And he had this, like, reckoning with himself, like, who am I really? What am I about? You know, it's kind of like, well, it's this, like, story of him, like, you know, leaving the stage and then, like, coming back, and he's, like, reborn like the phoenix, and he's, like, all this brutal honesty and all this other
right,
kind of stuff.
Right.
And I think about that, you know, I think about that a lot. And I think it's kind of important, you know, to put out things that I'm, like, it's almost weird. It's, like, it's kind of like lying and telling the truth. It's like, and when you're telling the truth, it's so much easier just to, like, communicate what you're experiencing and what you it's almost like you don't have to memorize things.
Yeah.
You just talk.
Right.
You know?
Right.
It comes from the gut.
Yeah. Well, Mark, I think that's probably a good place to wrap it up. Thank you for talking.
Sure. Thank you, man. Great.
You bet. And we're out.
Thank you very much again to Mark. I hope you found that enlightening. There was quite a bit of dense, thought-provoking stuff there, particularly towards the end. I don't know if you caught that and soaked that in. There's a lot to soak in there. I wanted to remind you, as always in this part of the show, that this is a listener-supported podcast, and I rely very much on the support of you, the listener. You can support the show in a number of ways. I love, love, love seeing emails saying you have received a donation. So that is my first choice. I'm aiming to get one donation per week from somebody, and it has been about roughly 10 days now. So if you have not donated to the show, it would be very much appreciated if you could. You can do so through theconversationpod.com. And I want to thank a recent big donator, artist Joseph Gurka, who is in Greenpoint, another Brooklyn artist. And yeah, I would love to hear from you New Yorkers, actually, in one way or another. You listen, but you are a quiet bunch for the most part. Thanks so much to Joseph Gurka. Thank you to my sort of mentor slash advisor, a guy named Harry Duran, who has his own podcast called Podcast Junkies. podcastjunkies.com. He actually talks to people who are podcasters themselves, many in sort of the business side of podcasting and business, but others just who have quirky podcasts. So if you're interested in the podcasting of podcasts or the podcast of podcasting, go check that out. He's been great in giving me free advice to try to grow the show. I also want to thank listener Matthew Joseph Tinkler, who has been helping doing a little intern social media type work for me recently. Thank you, Matthew. And of course, you can also support the show by spreading the word. Always appreciated. And you can leave a nice review and rating on iTunes, which helps more people find the show. The more people, the better. And of course, you can follow the show on the various social medias, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Am I missing anything? I don't think so. Thank you so much for being here. I appreciate your listening. And feel free to let us know what you thought of this episode or any other directly to me or through social media. And I will talk to you next week. Thank you again. Ciao for now.